This episode is brought to you by Carbonite, the leader in online backup. Backup your PC or Mac off-site securely and automatically. For a free trial offer plus 2 free months with purchase, go to carbonite.com. Offer code TWIM.
This week on the show, move over Microsoft. We've got a new bad boy in Facebook, the sexy app textbook conspiracy, and a bright spot for the news business. All this on This Week in Media, episode 183. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of This Week in Media. I am your host, Daisy Whitney, coming to you from the Twit Cottage. Hello, hello. Those of you who are watching live, as always, glad to be spending a Monday afternoon with you. For those of you who listen later on in the week, I am pleased that you listen. And you know me. I'm the host of the New Media Minute. I report on new media, online video, all that good stuff. Let me tell you who I am joined by today. As always, my fabulous companion, Tim Street. How's everything down in L.A., Tim?
It's a little cloudy today, Daisy. I don't know what's going on. We're getting this crazy San Francisco weather.
I know, it's rainy up here. We're going back to our little crazy San Francisco cold weather here. I'm going to be in L.A. tomorrow. I'm heading down for the day to the cable show.
I'll see you there.
Of course, we always run into each other. It would be it would be surprising if I didn't see you about 10 times tomorrow. Now Tim, of course, is a digital showrunner. He is the head of his company Ape Digital and also does French Made TV. That sounded funny the way I said that. That is his show that he produces. and we also have sort of our semi-regular now, and that is Lon Seidman with Local Online News TV in Connecticut. How are you, Lon?
Freezing.
Cold on the East Coast too, huh?
It is beyond. It's like fall, November. It's cold, but it's May.
What's going on? I can't even tell what time of year it is anymore with the weather. Of course, Local Online News TV is Lon's business. He started with. Was it a year and a half ago now?
About a year ago. Yeah, we're still alive, which is great. So we're excited. It's local political season up here, so we've got a lot of great local stories happening. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you as always for joining us. We have lots of interesting stories to cover, but before we get started, I want to let you know that this episode is brought to you by Carbonite, the leader in online backup. If you're not backing up, people, you need to be. Carbonite backs up your files automatically, whether you connect to the internet. It's your photos, music, emails, financial records, office documents, other irreplaceable files. It's very easy to use. You don't need any extra hardware. You don't need any cables. You can use it to recover lost files, to restore previous versions of files, transfer files. Does all sorts of cool things. And of course, as my father-in-law says, there are only two type of people in the world: those who have lost data and those who are going to lose data. The way you can avoid the direness of that situation is with a backup service. Unlimited backup for your PC or Mac is less than $5 a month or $55 a year, one flat rate. How do you get this? You can try it for free. Go to carbonite.com and please enter the offer code TWIM, T-W-I-M. If you decide to buy the service after the trial, you'll get 2 months free with the offer code TWIM. Carbonite.com, offer code TWIM. Check it out, people. All right, so Facebook. We continue to chronicle the behemoth, the monolith, the dictatorship that has become Facebook. Historian Reed Wright Webb on how to delete Facebook applications and why you should. Kind of following up on conversations we've been having over the last few weeks where we've been talking about what's going on with privacy and Facebook. And at Facebook's F8 conference, Mark Zuckerberg said that, did I say Zupper? It's Zuckerberg.
Yeah, you said Zupper.
The company is removing restrictions on user data retention within Facebook applications. What does that mean? That basically Facebook applications can keep and store all of your data, as I understand it. So this brings to light a lot of interesting things about Facebook. After reading this story, I went through and sort of deleted all of the applications that I hadn't used in a few months, really only leaving on, you know, maybe three or four Goodreads and a couple other things. Tim, is Facebook just becoming like the poster child for screwing you over?
I don't know. Do you know anybody that's been screwed over by this?
Well, okay, maybe not screwing you over, but for making people really unhappy. Are you saying it's much ado about nothing then?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, you know, I haven't seen anyone hurt by this yet, but it's scary.
Is it more of a PR thing then, Tim? Because it's a good point. You're saying, do you know anybody who was screwed over? No, I don't. I don't personally know anybody where Facebook or any of the application developers kind of messed around with their data. But I feel like we keep hearing about the possibility of this, and I wonder if this is more of, you know, sort of becoming it's the company that we love to hate now.
It does seem to be taking over. You know, you used to hear this type of stuff talked about about Microsoft all the time, and I haven't heard anybody say bad things about Microsoft in a long time, other than, you know, maybe this particular electronic device that no one uses, or this particular phone that isn't coming out yet. But other than that, you know, it does seem like there's a lot of venom towards Facebook, and for some reason, I don't have that venom. I mean, you know, in other stories we talked about, you know, there's been other things happening at Facebook. And hey, you know what? You don't like it, don't use it.
Right, right. And that's, of course, the important thing to keep in mind is that ultimately there are many things that you can do. You can delete your page, you can delete applications and all of that. I guess one of the things I wonder, though, with these stories is Facebook on a dangerous precipice right now, Lon? I mean, could it go the way of MySpace? I mean, with this type of coverage, with those concerns that are cited repeatedly in the media, is this a company that's sort of at a tipping point for starting to, for I guess for a lot of people starting to ditch the service again, then, you know, becoming the next MySpace, which is the company we make fun of as nobody uses it anymore.
Right. Well, I think what killed MySpace was Facebook, at least in my opinion. I mean, I know once the news feed came into play only, 4 years ago, if that, that's when it became a very compelling service to me. So I think the bigger threat to Facebook would be some other service that comes along that tries to do what they do better or offers a more compelling thing. I mean, clearly consumers are not concerned about privacy as much as a lot of us pundits are. Mainly because perhaps they're not informed as well as people who live and breathe in this industry all day long. The other thing that's been fascinating me about Facebook lately is that despite all the negative security issues and privacy issues that are coming out, more and more content providers, including myself, are putting that like button at the bottom of everything that we do because it's so powerful. And, you know, there's few places on the web where you have 400 million people congregating who are relatively truthful about who they are.
And so you installed the like button for local online news TV.
Right. Yes, I did.
And can you tell us how it's going? Any metrics or just any sense anecdotally of how it's being used?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Well, first of all, that site I emailed you offline, that likebutton.me, has been kind of a neat tool because it kind of looks into the Facebook social graph and sees who's doing what. You can't see who exactly
Was that exactly? That wasn't the thing that tells you when somebody unfriends you on Facebook, because somebody sent that to me recently.
No, that's something interesting. I didn't even know about that. No, likebutton.me is, I'm sorry, I think it's, I got the wrong site here. Yeah, likebutton.me is a site that's going into the new Facebook open graph, and it's looking at, you can actually specify your site as a favorite, and it'll dig through everything that's happening on Facebook related to URLs that you provide, and it will tell you which of your friends, of course, is sharing something that you are posting, but also who else on Facebook is. Now, you don't get the name of the person, but for example, one of our posts from our text site was shared 15 times by other
nice.
People. So it's almost like a Twitter search for Facebook now, which is kind of a neat tool. So it's
sort
of
like spying, but in a good way.
Right. Spying, at least in the sense that I don't know who exactly is doing it, but I can kind of get into a little bit to see what's going on Facebook. Because before this was implemented, you know, we'd see stories get tons of inbound traffic from Facebook, but have no idea what exactly happened. Because sometimes these are things that were out there from a month ago, all of a sudden are getting seen again. And it'd be kind of nice to know what's going on, if we can direct more content to people that are interested in that kind of story. You know, that we're a local provider. We need to be really, you know, tied into what our relatively small audience wants us to do. So That to me is pretty powerful. And for content providers, that becomes immensely powerful also. But on the flip side, you know, people should be more aware of what's going on. I have no doubt as Facebook continues to grow in influence and size, that we're going to see more states' attorney generals raise issues. We're going to see more actions in Congress to at least give some people some consumer protections to kind of guide them in this new and growing place. Because really, people do give up a lot of information that they may not be aware of when they go on one of these services.
You sort of know you kind of know you're really important once you've been sued by the U.S. government, right? Maybe that's what it comes down to. Now, Tim, yep. It seems as if you're a little bit more on the personal responsibility side, in the sense of, you know, hey, if something isn't working out, don't use it. If you're worried about privacy, don't share something you're not supposed to be sharing.
Well, I grew up in Florida. I'm a flip-flop. That's all there is to it. I mean, I'll go whichever way the story sounds good. Yeah. I do think that you should protect yourself. But at the same time, it's you don't have to use the service. You know, it's a free country. You know, as long as there's no laws against it, and maybe there will be some laws against it's buyer beware. But you're not buying anything.
I think that's fair to say. Now, Zynga and Facebook aren't really getting along so well, according to a TechCrunch article that says the relationship between Facebook and its biggest gaming partner, Zynga, is at an all-time low. Frustrations are going back to limitations on messaging users and how much of a fee each one is getting, and so on and so forth. You know, Zynga, of course, is the company behind Farmville, which is the most popular application on Facebook. And I guess the question here is, who has more to lose? Well, I think, you know, when you're talking about a company that's 400 million users and a company that's riding off of the back of that, it's probably Zynga that has more to use. But Lon, since you passed this on to me, what concerns do you think, what does this portend, really?
You know, this one struck me kind of similar to the issue people are having with Apple, Adobe versus Apple, or App Store developers versus Apple. It seems like we're getting these enormous networks being put together that are controlled by a single entity, whether it's a company or a group of companies or whatever. And, you know, they have very little control over how they can function within those communities. And this story, certainly, you know, Zynga has, hundreds of millions of users? I mean, Farmville is, I had to turn Farmville notifications off on my Facebook because that's all I was getting when I was popping in. So they have a lot to lose.
Did you ever play Farmville?
Never. I just don't even want to look at it.
Yeah, I've never played Farmville either.
I did Mafia Wars briefly, and then I was like just making billions of dollars and it wasn't any fun anymore. But the way I look at it, I mean, if you can make that much money in a fake world, I mean, imagine how much you could do in the real world, right? You know, they have a lot to lose here, certainly. I mean, they have built their audience from Facebook. I have no doubt they could go out, you know, to the iPhone platform or some other large network and probably do okay. But, you know, Facebook is getting 30% of their revenue right now and they have little control. They could go on PayPal and have that be 2 or 3%. So, you know, there's certainly some issues at stake here, and this might, again, attract government attention at some point.
Right. And indeed, that seems to be sort of the biggest thing to watch with something like this. Not so much a case of who has more to lose or what does it mean, but again, what it could signify for the future. Another interesting story is that Spotify, which is a UK-based kind of cloud music service, is going to be working on a US launch, according to CNNMoney.com. And this story was shared by one of our producers, by John Riley, huge music fan and kind of a big proponent of cloud-based storage. He said, you know, with cloud-based storage, you're essentially streaming the music, you know, and you're kind of, it's sort of like you're renting it while you're online. And the story says that although a specific launch date wasn't given, the goal is to launch this service in the U.S. By the end of 2010. Let's see, Spotify offers streaming music with more than 8 million tracks for free with ad support. And you basically pay a subscription fee, a rental fee, if you will, $15 per month. You can access the service with no ads. This is interesting because it's been popular in the UK, and certainly I've heard a lot of folks in the advertising business talk about this at kind of, you know, future of advertising type of conferences, that this is a service to watch, that there are interesting plays here. I guess what I'd like to understand is, you know, do people want to store their music in the cloud. It doesn't really have any appeal to me personally. I tend to be much more focused on, I want it on a device. I either want it just on the computer itself or on an iPod. And I'm somebody who likes a lot of cloud-based services. Tim, what are your thoughts on cloud-based music? I mean, will people pay a monthly fee to have unlimited streaming?
Yeah, I think they will pay that. For some people, that's the type of thing that they want, because they want to sample stuff that's new, that's different, and be able to check stuff out without paying more money. So, you know, for the cost of a CD, I think people are willing to do that. To me, what's really interesting here is how they're going to be able to compete in the U.S. market, because nobody's heard of this service before. Is it going to be bundled with something else? How will we get to it? I mean, I think we're on a big, you know, a big directional shift in moving into cloud computing, and you know, we're kind of on that early adopter curve as usual here. But I think eventually, you know, Walmart could be having, you know, a cloud service for stuff.
That as we become more accustomed to cloud-based services, that music is kind of a natural thing, that we're being trained to access, you know, not just Google services, but all sorts of other things, you know, solely on the internet, and this could be a natural next fit. Now, is it similar to, what about Pandora though? I mean, that's been kind of the de facto, you know, internet music site. What's the status of that?
Yeah, I'm not up on what kind of money Pandora's making.
Not much, probably.
Yeah, I don't think they're making that much. And, you know, I remember hearing like a year ago, year and a half ago, that, you know, the whole licensing fees for internet-served music was going up, and that was going to put internet radio companies out of business. So there's always that threat that's there. Pandora has a great brand. People really like it. They like the service a lot. They do serve a lot of ads, but I think Pandora is one of those things that kind of runs in the background, right, and people don't see the ads that are coming with it. I mean, if they were audio ads, which I think they may be doing, I'm not positive on that, I think that would be a more efficient play, because if somebody's listening to the music, they're going to hear the ad.
Right. Now, Lon, of course, we can't talk about music and what's happening with digital music without considering Apple. And does Apple even care? You wrote that down in your notes. I can't imagine Apple cares much. But at the same time, potential competition, sort of how does this play out vis-a-vis iTunes?
You know, it's a peculiar thing that Apple's gotten themselves into, because one thing they did just recently is approve an app from Rhapsody, which was on the iTunes store for a while, but the new version allows something that Spotify allows as well, which is actually downloading music and storing it on the device to play offline, which I think is a pretty significant development. Rhapsody is $10 a month, and you know, Spotify I think currently is what, 15, at least the equivalent U.S. amount. But you know, from the Apple perspective, you know, I Steve Jobs clearly in the past has not liked dealing with the record industry very well, and I'd probably add that half of the consumers of the record industry don't like dealing with the record industry. But you know, on the purchase of an app, I don't know how the subscriptions play into this, but Apple gets 30% of every app sale. So you know, from their perspective, maybe they'd prefer to make the money on the app than on the music sale, and have the iTunes store exist as a place where people who want to, you know, buy music outright would have it. But I just thought it was fascinating just to see that the Rhapsody app, you know, for all the hubbub over Adobe versus Apple and Apple versus Google on the Google Voice app, that here's something that clearly is competing with Apple in the iTunes market, in the sense, you know, in this case, Rhapsody and potentially Spotify, that you can go in, download it right now, use with your Rhapsody account, put music onto your iPod, unplug it from the network, and you're listening to stuff that you downloaded through your subscription. Pretty neat.
It's interesting to watch developments in the digital music business, because I think this is an area that sort of futurists at media agencies, at ad agencies are watching closely as well. You know, obviously everyone's trying to figure out sort of what direction consumers are going, what direction marketing and advertising is going to go. And some of the folks that I've talked to at agencies are looking at services like Spotify and just looking at just music in general, partnerships with bands, what have you, as a way for brands to affiliate with, you know, with things things that consumers like as it gets increasingly more challenging to actually reach it, you know, reach consumers and engage with them. So I think that interesting music plays will be watched both by consumers and also by brands to see if there are any sort of partnership opportunities. I mean, take the band OK Go, which is now State Farm, you know, was the sponsor behind its last YouTube music video. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as well and what sort of partnerships we might or might not see. Live streaming potentially under siege as we're sort of talking about, you know, regulations and, you know, what might or might not be regulated. So I find it interesting to kind of take a look at the role that technology is potentially playing in politics and in protests and the government. Now, what's happening is obviously a lot of political unrest in Thailand, and that a number of internet users have been trying to access Justin TV from within Thailand, and now they're being forwarded to a government website telling them that access to that is temporarily suspended due to an emergency situation, i.e. The protest, which has also been dubbed the Red Shirt Movement. This story comes from New TV. And again, I just think... it's interesting, Tim. You know, we had talked about the role of Twitter earlier in Iran and the elections there. This is a little bit more of a philosophical question, but it's really sort of interesting to see the role that technology can play in civil unrest.
Yeah, I think had Michael Jackson not died when he did that in Iran, things could have really kept bubbling up, because if you were paying attention to the Twitter stream at that time, that was the talk on Twitter. Every day was about the Iranian revolution. And when Michael Jackson died, it totally derailed the Iranian freedom movement. I mean, everybody had their Twitter profiles right. as green badges, and it was a huge thing. And Michael Jackson just totally derailed that. All attention went to that. All of this stuff, this social media stuff, it really makes it hard for bad guys to be bad guys.
And what issues does this raise about possible regulation of live streaming? Is this sort of now an area, Lon, that you think governments will be watching more closely, that regulatory agencies will be watching more closely and saying, okay, because it seems as if it's not quite like a whack-a-mole level or anything like that, but it seems as if, you know, when there are, you know, when there are these obviously political movements percolating, you know, their technology is used in different ways to kind of get the message out, whether it's watching or learning more about it, or in the case of Twitter, you know, sort of a combination of both. And now I wonder if live streaming sort of bubbles up as something to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. And you know, thankfully in the United States, to some degree, we have protections under the Constitution that give us the ability to speak. As we'll talk about later with net neutrality, that clearly is an area where people are going to try to find as much as they can do to try to limit some of the bandwidth that we might have to make that speech available to people. I found a great quote, which has been talked about on the Twit Network before, from John Gilmore, who said that the net interprets censorship as damage and routes around it. And I think it's such an apropos quote for all the civil unrest and you know, just civil speech across the world, because clearly, as we saw in Iran, there were many Americans and many other Europeans, people around the world, who were willing to take that information and get it out to the general public. And we saw on YouTube how many some really troubling imagery out of Iran had come out around all the Iranian censors, mainly because there were people willing to make that information available. And you know, clearly, it's I think next to impossible to really censor content online as these governments are trying to do. In fact, it makes it even more of a game to get the content out.
Lon, can you read that quote one more time?
Sure. The net interprets censorship as damage and routes around it.
I like that.
It's good. I think it really sums it up.
Yeah, no, I think that's fantastic. I like that. It's a good one. Toronto District School Board is considering replacing textbooks with ebooks. We've talked about what other educational institutions have done, and Princeton was sort of one of the early proponents of the Kindle DX, and our contributing producer Jason Perry, who's in Canada, you know, sort of brings up the whole idea of basically the Toronto School Board is looking to replace textbooks with digital copies, and it really makes a lot of sense if you think about it because, you know, news moves so quickly that what's in textbooks can often get updated. There are children that might be reading that thinking Pluto's still a planet. It's not a planet, people. It's a dwarf. Anyway, sorry. But the point is, textbooks are outdated very quickly, aren't they? So I think this brings up, it kind of dovetails nicely from the political story, but this again brings up an interesting idea of how, you know, how technology changes these other things, you know, other aspects of culture, you know, whether it's politics or education. And I guess the main question is, gosh, is this inevitable? I mean, do we see that we are moving towards a world where this is how kids will be reading in school, on some sort of e-reader, reading digital copies or what have you? What do you think, Tim?
Well, I think this is why Apple got rid of all the sexy apps in the App Store, is because they knew that come this fall, these kids are going to be buying iPads to go back to school, and they're going to have textbooks on it. And had they had all those sexy apps in the App Store when the iPad came out, the textbooks companies would not be jumping on board. But now that they've cleaned up their act, I think we're going to see more and more of it. And it makes sense. I mean, the downside of it, I mean, it's great for the environment, right? We're going to, you know, save trees and all that. That's good. And they'll save money on distribution. The downside, these kids aren't going to get any exercise carrying their books. They're just going to become really fat playing video games on their iPad instead of doing their homework.
Lon, what do you think? Is this the beginning of a new shift in education?
I do think it's inevitable, and I'm actually on my local school board, and this is something that we're always keeping an eye on because textbooks are expensive. Although textbooks right now, we buy them once, and then when they become outdated in a few years, we buy another set of textbooks, and you know, there's more of a, I would say almost a iTunes-like transaction here where you're buying content. When that content is now outdated, we buy more content. You know, with electronic textbooks, typically it's a license agreement, which means that the company you're doing business with is getting an annual fee. So for school districts, this may actually be more expensive in the end run. You would think it would be cheaper, but it's actually, you know, it could be more expensive in the end run, not to mention, you know, the device cost. And I think that, you know, those arrangements are likely to slow things down a little bit. But it also, though, creates an open source opportunity. You know, obviously we wouldn't maybe necessarily use Wikipedia as a first source for students, but there could be movements afoot that might try to lower the cost and bring some more competition into textbooks because they're very expensive to provide these books to students.
What does a textbook cost? I mean, because obviously an iPad and a tablet, those aren't cheap either. What does a textbook cost these days?
You know, I don't have per book costs. I'd have to go and look at our budget, but I know, you know, we have spent, you know, at any given point, you know, $20,000-$30,000 a year on textbooks for the school. So this is the elementary level for, you know, one subject area. So as we change curriculum, typically the curriculum has textbooks as part of that. And, you know, it's a very expensive operation. And college textbooks, as we all know, are also up there and continuing to increase in cost as well. So, you know, I think there's some advantage in definitely in the sense environmentally and in other areas. But the key is, I think, to make sure the business models work for publicly funded school districts and privately funded universities also, where students are paying out of pocket for these books as well.
It doesn't seem like who incurs the initial cost for something like that? I mean, in an elementary school district or a middle school, is it the student or the family that's paying for the books? Is it always the school? I.e., you know, could schools say, okay, now every year I have to buy school supplies for my children. It's $80 for the fourth graders next year, and you know, $40 for the kindergartners. You know, in a few years from now, will it be okay? One of the things that you have to buy for your kids, Ms. Whitney, is a tablet reader. I mean, does it become part of something that the school supplies, or is it something that the parents are paying for?
Well, in a public school, and again, it depends on local, you know, local state laws and rules and everything else. But typically, at least in Connecticut schools and the school board that I sit on, the taxpayers and, you know, and the school board pay for every supply that the student uses in the classroom. There are occasions where, you know, maybe there's a smock for art class or something, you know, right, outside of that they may have to buy. You know, right now, though, computers are really the responsibility of the parents. And one of the things that we see on the school board is that the children who do not have access to computers in the home are often at a disadvantage. And we talk about this digital divide and whatnot. you know, they often have to come into school early or stay late to get the work done that their peers can get done at home. So certainly having a device that can do some computing tasks and some word processing certainly would be a welcome device. But typically, you know, in a public school environment, the school would have to provide that. Private schools, though, are a different story, and as are colleges as well. So, you know, in those cases, you could ask the parents that this is one of the things that your child needs to have to go to school here.
It's interesting. I'm sure kids won't do anything else on it, like play games, and then it just becomes
of course
even.
Not.
It's just it's like it's like being an adult and going to a meeting and having your laptop, and no one knows if you're really taking notes or instant messaging your friends. The San Diego Tribune had a story last week that the nonprofit Internet Archive in San Francisco is going to be putting 1 million books online for the blind and dyslexic. Sort of an interesting project to make these books available for the visually impaired, using money from foundations, libraries, corporations, and the government. Of course, audiobooks, you know, have gone obviously a long way towards giving reading opportunities for those who are blind and so on. It's a great example of technology being used for good purposes, not evil purposes. But I wonder now, for you guys, as you're producing videos, and these are I've had these conversations with sort of, you know, my technical producer for the New Media Minutes, you know, kind of at what point do you make videos online? You know, do you add closed captioning, or, you know, do you add other tools? I know this project obviously relates to books, but I just kind of want to bring it back into that world of, you know, internet content producers. You know, what is feasible for a producer to do in terms of, you know, meeting the needs of the disabled and what's not? Tim, we'll start with you.
It's tough. You know, as an independent producer, you know, you're squeezing every penny you can to make something happen. And so to closed caption something is going to take a lot more time. Fortunately, YouTube is using Google's technology for voice recognition to bring closed captioning to YouTube. So that's in the works. It's not perfect yet, but it's coming along. And I think that's another big favor that Google is doing for the independent in helping us out.
Yeah, I do. No, the closed captioning is definitely terrific, and seeing that available is a wonderful thing. Lon, what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I agree. The closed captioning is a big help, and especially for sites that are doing government work and other things where you're required to provide accessible content, that's a huge thing, especially for independent producers. It's so difficult to do that, and it's good to see that the Internet Archive is also working on those things. They're a great resource also for independent providers. They have a lot of Creative Commons music and video clips that are freely available for content providers, and some of it can actually be used in commercial work like the stuff that Tim and I do. So definitely go through their archive. They have some amazing things on there.
Pretty cool. Now, finally, we've learned a little bit more about Google's plans in the ebook arena. I got to tell you, I'm a little bit unimpressed by this. Wall Street Journal had a story last week saying that Google plans to begin selling digital books in late June or July, according to a company official. And what this will be is basically Google e-editions, Google editions, and that you could access these Google editions, Google books, from a range of websites and a range of devices. So it kind of plays into what Google has done well, that kind of openness, the whole idea of being platform agnostic. That's always been an important part of Google's mission. But I don't get it. I don't see what the incentive is when you have the iPad out there, when you have the Kindle out there, even the Nook. I don't see what the incentive is going to be for consumers to buy books in the cloud. So help me out here.
Sure. Tim. It's Android. Android is the big thing. I mean, right now, they're giving away Android phones. I mean, buy one, get one free. And when the Android tablet comes out, I mean, that's where they're headed. They're trying to create content to fill that. And I think Android is going to steal away a lot of the iPad developers. If you look at the number one website that was out there, actually is the number one podcast for iPhone developers called Mobile Orchard. The guy, Dan Grigsby, who ran it, got so upset with Apple that when they said you weren't going to be able to use third-party development tools to develop iPhone apps, he's like, that's it. I quit. He stopped doing the podcast. He stopped blogging on his blog, and it was the number one blog for developers in that space. I think he's probably going to shift over to Android. And I think a lot of people are going to follow him there. So, you know, by fall, I think that's when we're going to see a lot of activity in the Android space. But it's quickly catching up to the iPhone.
Okay, now, Lon, before we get to that Tim, great point, and research that came out just today from NPD Group that's getting a lot of buzz online, is NPD Group is saying that based on its research for the first quarter of this year, mobile operating system numbers, that BlackBerry still dominates the market. Well, not dominates, not quite the right word, but still has 36% of the mobile operating system market, compared to 28% for Android devices and just 21% for the iPhone. So it says that the Android has surpassed the iPhone. It's weird because it doesn't feel that way. I mean, it feels like everybody has an iPhone, and you certainly don't hear consumers talking about their Droid phones in the same way that you hear people talking about their iPhones. And it's funny because, you know, I used to have a BlackBerry. Now I have now I have an Android phone. When you have a BlackBerry, you know, if you're talking to someone, say like, oh yeah, I'll send you a BlackBerry message, or similar to the iPhone, it kind of becomes part of the cultural lexicon. You're like, oh yeah, I'll get back to you from my iPhone, but nobody says, yeah, I'll just send you a message from my Droid, unless you're tech geeks like us. Because it just I would never say that to somebody. I would just say to somebody, oh yeah, I'll be on my BlackBerry today. You know, like if a client is asking you, for instance, will I be able to reach you today? Yeah, I'll be on my BlackBerry, even though I don't have a BlackBerry, I have an Android. But these numbers are suggesting this got huge coverage today, and I just, you know, did a Google News search. I mean, huge coverage on this. Obviously, this is saying that it's surpassing the iPhone.
No, I'm not surprised.
Lon, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. You know, I think the biggest problem that AT&T is going to, or Apple's going to have moving forward, is that they are still stuck to one carrier. Android is on all carriers now. Android looks different depending on which device and which carrier that you're on, but nonetheless, you know, that operating system is making significant inroads, mainly because, you know, people who are happy with their carrier and don't want to switch to AT&T are not switching. I was one of the people that switched because I wanted an iPhone when it came out, but both my sister and brother have Droids, mainly because they wanted an iPhone, but they couldn't get one because it wasn't on Verizon, right? And this was an acceptable alternative to them. So, you know, that's, I think, the ropes. It'll be intriguing to see if Apple decides to bring a CDMA version of the iPhone over to Sprint and to Verizon this summer. But they have to do something because they will give up market share.
It's easily. Almost as if the Android is sort of like a private label service. It's because it's not, I mean, not really, but in the sense that you hear people talk about the iPhone or you hear people say BlackBerry, those sort of have a brand cachet, if you will, behind them. But the Android is sort of in the background, but is slowly powering, or maybe even not slowly anymore, a lot of the devices. When you go into a store now, or T-Mobile or whatever, and say, okay, I want a new phone, chances are you're going to get an Android. And Tim, what you're saying is that as that growth continues, that gives Google the device market, if you will, to have a broader reach with Google Editions. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. So it'll, you know, and also the other driver that's there, like Steve Jobs said, if you want adult content, go get a Droid. And if
that's
we
an
look
endorsement.
At, if we look at history, in terms of technology, most of the groundbreaking technology leaps and bounds, we have adult content to thank.
And it's all about human nature, right? Those animal impulses. Speaking of iPhones, iPads, and the AT&T network. Lon, take us through this story about iPad 3G video downscale. This was a story that's written about, was this in iLounge? Yeah, iLounge.com had a story about this, that some video delivery applications are acting differently over the 3G network than they do on Wi-Fi. Explain that, if you will.
Well, I know from, I don't actually own a 3G iPad, but I do have a 3GS iPhone. And YouTube quality, for anyone that's ever tried to watch a YouTube video on 3G, has always degraded to a lower level of compression, which kind of, honestly, no better way to put it, looks like crap. and it seems to me, and I haven't seen this on the 3G iPad yet, and I think ABC actually did something to their app to kind of address this, but the video quality is reported as not being as good as it would be if you were on Wi-Fi. And that's to be obviously expected to some degree. But if it's a purposeful reduction like they did with YouTube, I could see that, you know, being an issue for some people.
And now, as we've been talking about regulation, net neutrality, and things like that, according to the New York Times, FCC push to regulate broadband is expected. Chairman of the FCC will try to regulate broadband internet service despite a recent court ruling that the commission had limited powers to do so, according to this story. FCC officials have said that the FCC chairman is expected to announce that the commission considers broadband service a sort of hybrid between an information service and a utility, and that it has sufficient power to regulate internet traffic under existing law. This could be a victory for content companies like Amazon and Google, who don't want ISPs to have the power to charge them for access to customers or for faster download speeds. Tim, what does this what does this say about net neutrality, where we're going, all of that stuff?
It says that there's another shot fired in this battle, and it's going to keep going for a little while until there's solid law that supports it. I think we're going to see people pushing the boundaries and trying to see what they can and can't get away with, because there's a lot of money to be made here if the cable companies and the other internet service providers can charge for packet priority, meaning that if they can say, hey, Fox, we will serve your videos faster and ahead of all other videos if you pay us X amount per month to make that happen. So that's some big bucks that are on the table. And the other thing, for the cable companies, the over-the-top videos are a big thorn in their side, because, people are paying for their cable service and they pay for the programming that's there, but they're not paying for the programming that's being delivered by those who have cut the cable, even though they're using their cable provider to get to the internet. And that's really frustrating to them, that they're not getting a piece of that, and they want to be able to charge for that. So I'm sure that's going to be a big topic again this week at the National Cable Show.
Indeed, it probably will be. Lon, what do you think?
Well, I think this might actually force Congress to take some serious action on this. There's been bills that have been brought up to either protect net neutrality or get rid of it. And I think clearly the court case really raise the issue once again that Congress needs to add some details to the laws that regulate public utilities and potentially regulate the internet as well. And that's the battle ahead, as Tim said. Congress typically, especially on complex issues, likes to have the regulatory agencies kind of interpret the law. But in this case, the law needs to be written to try to direct people in the right direction. And I hope that neutrality wins out. It's going to be a fight, because these guys have a lot of big money and big lobbyists behind them trying to make this case, and very non-technical people making the decision too. So
we're giving Congress a lot to work on today. Hey, yeah, Congress, listen to this show. We've got all sorts of tips on technology areas that you should be you should be focused on. This is kind of cool what's going on with Roku. We've talked about Roku a lot on this show. Netflix, really kind of a killer app for the Roku service. But one of the challenges with Netflix has been that you've got to be going dancing back and forth between the computer and the actual Roku setup. Because if you have Netflix service and you want to watch something on your Roku, you've got to set it up on your computer. You've got to get on your PC or your Mac and get whatever you want to watch into your queue. And then once you've set it up in your queue, then go on over to your Roku, to your Blu-ray player, to your game console, whatever it is. And now with this new version of Roku players that are coming out next month in June, that basically you would be able to do all of that at the same time, as I understand, that you could basically do that on the Roku device itself, and you don't have to go back and forth. CNET story on this topic is one that I'm referencing. And I wonder how greatly or not does this expand Netflix's reach into the over-the-top world? It's already become kind of the poster child, the service that most people are using. Tim, does this expand its reach even further? And what does this do for Roku?
Well, that service is already available on the Wii, and so you still have to set it up initially on the Wii, but once you want to add stuff to your instant queue, you can do that using the Wii, and that's fantastic. I think the big challenge here, though, is going to be for middle America and for people that may not have gaming consoles and may not want another box in their house. That's the tough part. But if they can get this done in time for, you know, fourth quarter, and it makes a great Christmas gift, and it's easy for grandma to use, if they buy it for grandma and they hook it up for grandma, then grandma can watch all her favorite movies. That's a win-win, but it's still that setup. But it's way easier to set up than a TiVo. So I do think we're going to see more penetration, and it will come out. But the real win-win is when it's already bundled in the TV, when you buy the TV and it comes with this service.
Now, I found a TiVo box in my closet this weekend. Sort of interesting. I was, you know, just putting a jacket away. Oh, look, there's TiVo. I haven't watched TiVo in a long time. But, of course, I do have my Roku set up. So much for TiVo. Lon, what are your thoughts on this? Will this lead to more internet content on television?
I hope so. I think Netflix is kind of the way in for all of us as independent content providers, as, you know, more and more of these boxes get out there. And, you know, it's Roku, but it's also, you know, like you said, the Blu-ray players and the other devices. I mean, people are getting on Netflix where they have a motivation to plug in an IPTV box into their lives. That's a great first start. My hope is that Netflix would actually subsidize these boxes. Maybe they should do a year subscription thing or whatever. Because the box, I think, is about $100. There's a $90 standard definition version, right?
And it's a little bit more expensive. I mean, there are a range of prices for the Roku, but yeah, it's pretty inexpensive.
But, you know, I was looking around holiday time. I bought a Blu-ray player for $50 more than a Roku box. You know, so that value judgment that people might have in purchasing something, I think if they could, you know, find some way to really offer these boxes at a subsidized rate. To get them out there, because we as content providers could really use some kind of standard. I talked about this the first time I was on. You know, it's hard to get our stuff out everywhere because we have to know how to program for every platform there might be out there. I just want my RSS feed to show up somewhere. So if Roku or somebody else becomes the market leader, and I hope they would, I really like their product. Boxy is also fantastic. And I hope, you know, maybe between the two of them, we'll see some more penetration and getting more independent content out there.
And pursuant to Tim's point about, you know, Roku should work for grandma and all of that, I think changes like this, making it more integrated into it, will make a difference. We installed, my husband and I installed, he did most of the work, a Roku for a friend recently. And it was interesting to kind of, you know, be looking at it from the perspective of, you know, hearing the comments from another person who's, you know, who's obviously a smart, intelligent person, but isn't enmeshed in technology every day as we are, saying like, wow, so okay, so this takes about 15 minutes to set up. Granted, not a lot of time, but still, it's still, you know, pulling out the TV, figuring out exactly what input it's supposed to go in, and then the whole setup process with Netflix as well, and authorizing it and putting in that, you know, 5-number code on the TV. And I still think those are barriers to entry for most people, and it's important to kind of keep an eye on it. It might seem really simple, and it is really simple to a lot of folks, probably to the folks who listen to the show, but getting rid of that complicatedness is going to help. Some really interesting research came out last week from Brightcove and Tube Mogul about online video usage. The two of them basically kind of took a look at the first quarter of 2010, looking at the media industry, broadcast networks, music labels, newspaper publishers, kind of seeing, you know, who's watching what, who's doing what. Not surprisingly, stream growth substantially up across all different sectors. What I found really interesting in this report was that there was a huge spike in video publishing activity driven by newspapers and by magazines, that newspapers did 2 billion video player loads across their websites in the first quarter of this year. That was up 37% from a year ago. Magazines, 1.2 billion player loads in the first quarter, up 70% from a year ago. And that similarly, the usage, the time spent, the amount of time consumers are watching video on their sites has gone up. Newspapers and magazines, according to this research report, have the highest video viewing completion rates, higher even than broadcasters and music labels. This is interesting, of course, because most of the stories we hear about the newspaper and publishing business is how crappy it is right now. And I wonder if this is a case of we're finally starting to see a surge in interest by consumers that might then in turn lead to interest from advertisers. We've got Tim back. So, Tim, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think this is one of those things where it's like they're finally realizing what business they're in. I mean, number one, it's a new revenue stream for them, so that's great. They're excited about that. But at the same time, you look back at history, you look at the train companies. Train companies when airplanes started coming out, when these jet services were available, they were like, well, we're trained people. We're not in the airline industry. And they went out of business. And the same thing has been happening in newspapers. And now they're realizing instead of being a paper business, they are a news business. And however they can get that news to their customers, that's what their customers want. Just like travelers wanted to travel from one place to another and get there as quickly as they could, people want the information that they want, and they want to consume it in a way that they can best consume it. And, you know, if that's a paper because of they have no internet connection, that's one thing. But if they have an internet connection or they're able to download a video and watch it, that's an opportunity for them to consume that information and get that news that they really want.
Lon, will the money follow?
I hope so. we're actually doing some partnership agreements with a local paper in Connecticut called the Journal Inquirer. So we're doing some video for them. So we're their video provider. So when there's a video in a story, we typically are the one providing that. And we've talked to a few other papers in the state as well. You know, the Journal Register companies have been really trying to get aggressive with video. They've given flip cameras out to all of their reporters now as well. And we were talking to them about doing some video, and they kind of backed out of it at the last minute. So, you know, I think they're still trying to understand where they fit. I think there's clearly, you know, news really is more of a commodity than it used to be, mainly because, you know, you're no longer committed to one source of media. And, you know, whoever's got the stuff is going to get watched or read or both. And I think that's a hard time that the news, as Tim pointed out, that the newspapers are having a hard time adjusting to that. To that environment. And, you know, we're out there putting stuff into the ecosystem, as they say, and we're getting picked up by a few papers occasionally, and we'll keep working on that as well.
But if you're in Connecticut, you should be following local online news TV. Lon, where do you want people to find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Lon Seidman, LonSeidman, and our website is localonlinenews.tv.
Excellent. Tim, where do you want people to find you?
They can find me at onetimstreet.com and check out my new podcast, SM Biz, on iTunes.
And that's all about what? So people know what they're checking
out? It's all about small business.
All right. Excellent. Hence SMB. And you can find me at daisywhitney.com, and I go by my name on Twitter. So I hope to see you there. This mess you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.